Mallory, and I'm just sitting in Pilsen waiting for a Tinder date. But you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Mal, keep the faith. That date will be there in no time. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 911. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. So good morning to Fergie. And again, I am so happy that you are here joining the show today. Boy, I have to say, it's good to be back home. Earlier in the week, my family and I went on a spring break jaunt to Florida. We had a great time, and there were actually a lot of people from Chicagoland who were down there with us. I lost count of the number of Justin Fields and Caleb Williams conversations I had with random people. And to the extent I could, I unplugged. I did some leisure reading on the beach, played board games with my family, and ate some delicious meals. You know, vacation stuff. And for the first time in a long time, I wasn't scrambling to keep up with the news, especially around Chicago. So when we got back towards the end of the week, I wasn't even aware that the Chicago water taxi is making a comeback, starting today, actually, since first limiting service in 2019. Awesome. The state's attorney's race? Well, we're just taking our time there, apparently. And the Blommer chocolate factory in the city is closing. That's a bummer. But when you get home from vacation, do you ever feel like you need a vacation from your vacation? I mean, you think about it. We were eating a lot of meals out. We were on the go looking for fun activities for the kids. And sure, there's that beach downtime I mentioned. And that's great, but the feeling of sleeping in your own bed again after some time away is pretty wonderful. So right now, I'm tired, but ready to deliver a show just for you. Florida, you were pretty fun. Although the three-story billboard that said in huge letters, Trump won, was a little over the top. All right, I am a little loopy from traveling, but the coffee is fresh, and here's our game plan. In the Secret History of Chicago Music segment, we learn about a local blues guitar shredder. Also, in the wake of Governor Pritzker's announcement about the plan to raise Stateville Prison, we hear from someone who thinks we should keep that facility around as a history teaching tool. And what's up with vacant lots near CTA train stations? We find out. Sure is good to be back home. Vacant land in Chicago has been an issue for decades. These pieces of land have negative impacts on surrounding residents, property values, and crime rates, not to mention creating a sense of blight in neighborhoods. And there is a large concentration of vacant lots located near CTA stations. So what are the implications of this? Well, Jeff Smith is the executive director at the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University, and that group partnered with a few other local organizations to investigate this issue and produce a new report. The website is housingstudies.org, and Jeff is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Jeff, nice to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. So let me ask you this. At the outset, why do a deep dive into vacant land located near public transit in Chicago? What were you trying to do here?
Yeah, so as you noted in the intro, we worked on this project with a number of other organizations, one group, Elevated Chicago. Their mission is essentially to promote what are known as equitable transit-oriented development policies. So what does that mean? Transit-oriented development policies have been implemented in Chicago for many years, and the idea is to create incentives for developers to build dense, walkable neighborhoods near train stations. If you look at a map as to where those types of developments typically happen, they're often in high-cost neighborhoods on the city's north side. And when you look at a map of where they really aren't happening, it's oftentimes along transit corridors on the city's south and west side. So one of the goals of this report and this work was to highlight those patterns and that issue to try to raise awareness of the need to add that equitable, that E kind of to the ETOD, equitable transit-oriented development conversation, to highlight that there needs to be maybe different types of strategies or different types of approaches to really attract investment to other parts of the city that have been historically disinvested so that you can maximize the kind of transit assets in those neighborhoods.
Yeah. So as you note in your report, where we're seeing these vacant lots, these vacant spaces, these places are primarily in communities that have been marginalized, and they're primarily in communities of color. That's where we're seeing this happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, it probably isn't going to be a surprise necessarily to anyone who understands the city, follows the city's history, that vacant land is largely concentrated in the city's predominantly Black neighborhoods. I think one of the things that we were surprised to see in the data when we looked at vacant land and how vacant land relates to transit nodes is that there's actually a higher concentration of the city's vacant land near transit in the city's predominantly Black communities than just the distribution of vacant lots overall. So there are more lots, 90% of the city's vacant lots near transit were in predominantly Black neighborhoods, whereas 80% of the city's total vacant lots were in predominantly Black neighborhoods. So that again is an indicator that, looking back, looking at challenges, it's kind of a way to highlight that the disinvestment has created this vacant land. But also, looking forward, I think it's a way to underline that there's potentially an opportunity to shape what future development might look like on those vacant lots.
So you said that these vacant lots, there are a substantial amount of them located near the CTA and CTA stations. Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing that and I'm thinking to myself, well, what's going on there? Because we say, and then the city has said and has done this with its focus on transit-oriented development across Chicago, or in certain areas of Chicago, I should say. I mean, if you've got areas that are closer to public transit, does it stand to reason that maybe it would, be easier to invest in these communities, to put something there? Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I mean, so transit-oriented development policies typically rely on the market. I mean, there are incentives to attract private market investment. And so the areas where that private market investment is most profitable, let's say, tends to be in higher cost neighborhoods where there isn't, demand for housing from higher income households. Those are the neighborhoods where, regular real estate developers who don't need to access subsidy necessarily are able to take advantage of those incentives to build denser housing and be profitable. Other parts of the city, the market, unfortunately, doesn't quite work out in the same way. So the private market is not investing in those neighborhoods in the same way. And therefore, the subsidies as they currently exist don't necessarily work as successfully in more historically disinvested neighborhoods. So there needs to be additional supports, additional strategies, different ways of thinking about how to support either real estate development or other types of repurposing of that vacant land to create those kind of more walkable, equitable neighborhoods on the south and west sides near transit.
And from your report here, you say that over 43% of Chicago's city-owned vacant land is located within a half mile of a CTA train station. And 90% of these city-owned transit-accessible lots are in predominantly Black communities. So there's this difference that you note in the report of city-owned vacant lots versus privately-owned vacant land. And the numbers are similar-ish, I suppose. But, I mean, the city, I look at that and, hey, the city owns this land, right? And it's vacant. So does that mean that the city can maybe put something there quicker or faster or more easily in order to generate some sort of buzz around the neighborhood or some sort of development?
Well, the words you say, quicker, faster, easier, are not often associated with city, you know, development processes, I don't think. So,
true.
In theory, they do have control at the very least. You know, they have the ability to control the outcome of what happens on those parcels. So in that case, you know, there is that option, you know, that opportunity to say, hey, we think of these neighborhoods near transit as assets, and therefore the city wants to be able to have control over what goes there and have it be aligned with their policy goals, right? So I think that's the opportunity. But as I, you know, we kind of joked about just a minute ago, it's complicated. The city is not a nimble entity. You know, there's a lot of mistrust between the community and the city that's built up over decades. And, you know, recent mayors have tried to build that trust back, but I think it's a long process. And so I do think there are still challenges around leveraging that asset. And I say it's an asset, you know, that the city owns that real estate. It is an asset and an opportunity, but deploying that asset and redeveloping that asset in a way that's aligned with those, you know, what the community wants is a process that takes time. And I think that that's part of the challenge, is kind of building that trust, aligning those developments in a way that is beneficial to the city, but also to the community. You know, we have seen some, you know, there are a couple of big programs that were initiated under the Lightfoot administration. You know, Invest Southwest was a kind of a high profile program. And a number of those projects were, you know, the goal was to be a catalytic in development project near transit. So these are bigger, high profile developments that were trying to leverage transit proximity. And in theory, the scale of those developments was going to then attract other developments to the neighborhood. And so a lot of those are still in process right now, but I think that the city has tried to kind of take steps to redevelop some of these sites and attract other market investments. So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, I think it's still, you know, an ongoing process.
This speaks to, I think, just development of a neighborhood and a community, because as we've been talking about, okay, if the city decided magically that, hey, we're going to put something in these vacant lots, I mean, if something were to go up tomorrow, that doesn't mean that things are going to be magically transformed. I mean, there's a lot of work that has to happen besides this, but do you see this as kind of like a stepping stone or one sort of cog in the bigger machine in order to try to reinvest in these communities? Because look, they're sitting so close to these CTA stations. I feel like if this were to happen, that's great. But I mean, I think it goes to show how much other work needs to be done as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's clearly a lot of investment that needs to happen, you know, comprehensively across neighborhoods to make them more equitable. I think transit nodes in particular, though, are one of a key, you know, one type of key community asset that can be leveraged to attract investment, and it can also increase access to other parts of the city, increase neighborhood walkability, increase neighborhood public health outcomes. So I think there are a lot of ways that investing in, starting at least, in those areas near transit can potentially have a ripple effect to the broader community. But it's a process, as you note. I mean, I think that this is what, you know, and we've worked with the folks at Elevated Chicago and the other, you know, organizations that were part of this project, the Andaleo Institute near the 95th Street Red Line Station, and the Fairfield Park Community Council at the Kedzie Green Line Station. You know, those guys have, you know, are part of bigger community initiatives where they're trying to redevelop the 95th Street Commercial Corridor, trying to, you know, attract investment to East Garfield Park, but leveraging that key transit node as one of the anchors, so to speak, of that investment and leveraging that asset for the community.
So what can we do with this information here? Because there is a lot of it in this report and it's pretty detailed. So is the idea here that civic leaders, city leaders can look at this and sort of map out a strategy for investing in some of these neighborhoods that historically have not seen that investment?
Yeah, I think, you know, from one, you know, one perspective, which is to raise awareness. I mean, I think that there are ongoing efforts to, you know, invest in neighborhoods, you know, near transit and use transit as a community asset. But I think that you know, it's important to not lose sight of those projects and the needs of the community and the importance of the transit network. I mean, I think especially, you know, nowadays in the post-COVID sort of context, you know, transit ridership is down. And I think, you know, we don't want to lose sight of this network as a key asset, long-term asset for the city. So I think investing in neighborhoods near transit, investing in walkable communities, that you know, those are continuing to be key priorities, and ensuring that those investments are reaching all parts of the city are important. So they had the goal to support is to kind of raise awareness. And there's a second, you know, kind of piece, the part that I mentioned, our partners at Elevated and our community partners as well. Sort of, there are some videos that that were recorded with neighborhood residents walking the community, talking about, you know, the vacant lots that they're walking past, and just sharing what they want to see happen on those blocks and with that land. So I think it's also to raise awareness of that community perspective and the importance of, you know, hearing that perspective is has a lot of value. I think besides the data, just hearing the community perspective and seeing some of the, you know, the what people want to see happen with that land is also an important part of the process.
The implications here of vacant land near transit hubs. This is an interesting report, and again, can show us maybe a little, or give us an idea, I should say, of how we can reinvest in some of these communities in Chicago. We can check out the website housingstudies.org for the full report. And Jeff Smith is the executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. Hey, Jeff, I always appreciate the time, and thanks for all of your hard work.
Yes, appreciate the opportunity to talk about our work. Thanks a lot.
Governor Pritzker recently announced a plan to demolish the Stateville Correctional Center. It's a maximum security prison outside of Joliet, and the Logan Correctional Center, located outside of Springfield. The cost of this would be about $900 million over the next 5 years. So, focusing in on Stateville here for a minute, Stateville actually has the worst conditions of any correctional facility in the state. But not everyone is on board with demolition, though. Layla Wills is the executive director of the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and she argues that the Stateville prison site is one that should be preserved and repurposed for historical education. Layla is with us here today on Outside the Loop. Layla, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for covering this issue.
You are quite welcome. And we should mention that you're not the only person who opposes the demolition of this site, but I think your angle on this is really interesting here. So can you explain why this prison, why Stateville Correctional Center, is important in our understanding of history?
Prison has become purposely, ever since the Emancipation Proclamation, they would round up Black people. After slavery was outlawed, the only way in the Constitution you could get free labor was through if there were prisoners. And ever since then, prison has become a part of Black culture, of Black people being rounded up. That was a big reason for the Black Panther Party, was because of police occupation in Black neighborhoods. And if you got caught in the criminal justice system, if you got arrested for any reason at all, there was a 90% chance you were going to be in prison. And in this day and age, when people say, when and you know, with these police killings and different things that happen, and part of our society will say, well, why didn't they just do what the officer told them and this, that, and the other? When we were growing up, it was like if a police car came down the block, you were to run away from the police department. Mm-hmm. Now, in this day and age where on one hand, our elected officials are talking about social justice, restorative justice, and issues like that. So you can't talk restorative justice and all these other things and then immediately go to a bulldozer to tear down these painful places of our collective history without talking to the community that has been affected by mass incarceration the most.
So you would want to see then Stateville preserved, and in the sense that we have this history with incarcerating African Americans in this country. And today, I mean, if we look at the incarceration rate, even in Illinois, we still see that Illinois has about 14% of the African American population. That's the number in this state. Yet over half of those folks incarcerated African Americans. So there's a huge disproportionate situation there. So what you're saying here is you would want to keep this building around and what, turn it into some sort of museum or educational facility where we can explore the history of policing and the African American people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a lynching museum in Alabama. They have Alcatraz open for tours. I believe part of Sing Sing is also, and this and Stateville, I know it's a massive campus, so I don't think, you know, I'm sure it's not practical to do something like that for the entire campus, but I do think that they need to save part of this and let the public have tours there. It is a learning experience. It's part of our collective history. And even the governor of Illinois, you know, in 1998 or 99, Governor Ryan, when he commuted everybody on death row, he said the system itself was broken. Stateville was one of the most violent places, violent penitentiaries. What if you were arrested falsely and railroaded through the criminal justice center and you ended up in a place like that? You know, that is a loss of life that has affected a lot of Black families. And I think it is totally irresponsible for our elected officials who were put there by the people to be so insensitive to just say they're going to bulldoze these Stateville. It's the same I'm going through with landmarking the Black Panther Party. The main locations of the party have been completely bulldozed. They are either empty lots or something else altogether. Cabrini Green, bulldoze. All these people are displaced. I don't think we are understanding restorative justice and social justice issues enough.
Yeah, so it's interesting because what you're saying here, look, if we get rid of this, we're erasing the memory here. And look, these memories are painful, but yes. That's part of the point here, I think, is that we have to understand the painful memories in order to go forward here. And I think it's interesting because the Black Panther Party, there's some history with Stateville. The Black Panther Party, they were chartering buses in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and they were going down to Stateville. Can you tell us what was going on with the Panthers and going to Stateville?
The party realized what was going with it, with Black people being herded into prison. And they used to take people in Illinois and from Chicago down to Joliet and Stateville. They took them to Menard and the other locations as well. Some of these people who went had loved ones locked up. Others were going for educational purposes. And the Panther Party also had a prison reform group where they would go down there. And if you talk there, we still have Panthers today who go to the prisons. These people aren't throwaways. There are people who care about them. And that's another issue, is that these prisons are all hundreds of miles away. And the only objections that are coming are from people scared to lose their job. The economy of small town America, that is very parasitic to people who are the victims of mass incarceration. And that's why I just think this is a very insensitive way the governor is going about this.
So in terms of what you'd like to see, you said you would like to see Stateville preserved. You came out with a statement recently. So where do you go from here? I mean, the governor made this decision. Are you lobbying his office? Where do you go here in terms of your advocacy?
So I haven't heard back from the governor, and I appreciate you covering this topic because of the way that it came out on a Friday, last Friday. A lot of people don't even know about it. So some people are getting up to speed, and we are consulting with each other to see the next move. From what I heard, the legislators were in session in Springfield, and I don't think there was any movement on this issue there. So I will be contacting my elected officials and to see what's up and do I need to go there? Like, what are we going to do here?
Right.
So I'll figure it out. But we are not. We want that main building and at least another building where they house those inmates to remain as a place of learning for all of us. It's for all of us so that we don't go back to the same kind of behavior again. And where do we go from here? Also, one last thing, Mike, is that if we tear these kinds of places down, which has been done all these years, the history is in school books, right? Would be in school books. School books can change depending on the different administrations at the time. Look at what's going on in Florida. Here we have a good opportunity for a living example, living proof on what happened in the state of Illinois when it comes to incarcerating Black people. And I think we need to take advantage of that.
Before I let you go here, Layla, I have to ask you, the effort to landmark certain places around Chicago for history pertaining to the Black Panther Party, you and I spoke about that a while ago on this program. Do you have an update for us? How's that going?
It's going really well. We had a fundraiser to raise money for historical markers, and I think we're up to like 13 markers. So now we're going through the red tape of the permitting process in Chicago, if you can imagine. And then it has actually grown into the Black Panther Party Heritage Trail in Illinois because of the great feedback that we're getting, and a lot of people are excited about it. And we are building partnerships and are going to have markers even down in Carbondale and Peoria, up in Waukegan, and other places where the party had programs.
Well, we can check out the website ilbpp.org and the work that you're doing preserving the history of the Black Panther Party in Illinois is really important, and giving us a perspective on this prison issue is also, I think, very important and gives us a lot to consider here. So again, we should check out the website. Layla Wills is the executive director of the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. Layla, I always appreciate the time and best of luck with all of your efforts.
Thank you again for covering this issue, Mike. I appreciate it.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Cold chill, cold chill, come over me when I see my baby walk, when I hear my baby talk.
Oh yeah, connecting once again to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music strip. In the Chicago Reader, he is also a music historian and artist and musician, and I think this is going to be the last of the winter blues profiles here as part of The Secret History of Chicago Music. But it's Chicago weather, so who knows? But Steve, we're talking about a blues man by the name of Hip link chain.
Yeah, I mean, you know, technically winter is over, and I do tend to abide by that, but, you know, we had some snow flurries, it was in the 30s, I'm like, I'm still feeling it, and yes, Hip Link Chain was a guy I sort of discovered writing up what I thought could be the other Last Winter Blues character, Dusty Brown. And I just checked him out, and not only, yeah, did we agree he had the coolest name in the universe, Hip Link Chain, he rules. He completely rules. What a guitar player. So, like, I had to sneak in this little post-winter blues, if you will.
Yes. So we are talking about Hip Link Chain. He is rocking the blues guitar, and his story starts in 1936. He's born Willie Lee Richard, which, again, I think would make a pretty good blues name, you know?
It would make him blend in with some guys who had similar names, is the only thing I would say. But, yeah, totally, obviously, very legit sounding bluesman name there. But, yeah, I guess he had like a sort of childhood nickname where the hip part comes from. And then his dad used to wear these chains around his neck as a logger, I believe. Logging chains, yeah, around his neck. So that's where, yeah, his nickname was Hipstick as a kid, which I feel like I've heard that term before, but I don't know exactly what it means.
Well, that's the origin, the genesis story of Hip Link Chain.
Yeah.
I kind of like that story. So he's born in Mississippi. He's from the Mississippi Delta, and he's picking cotton when he's really young.
I mean, that is like the most, you know, that story, so many of the great bluesmen, that's where they started, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And when he's 18, he goes to Chicago in 1954, and basically from the moment he gets here, it sounds like he's getting right to work in blues clubs, and this is, again, the best music education you can get. He's seen some of the greats.
Oh, yeah, totally. It sounds like, you know, he had some great harp players, Lester Davenport and Dusty Brown, who you mentioned, sitting in with them. And, you know, yeah, he could go see Magic Sam. And I read somewhere he might have collabed with Magic Sam, but I actually couldn't confirm that. And, yeah, I mean, unlike a lot of these other dudes, he recorded a fair amount in the day, too. A lot of these guys were sort of, you know, under-recorded until they sort of had a revival in the 80s. But he recorded with Dusty Brown's band as early as 59. And then he was actually able to put out his own single. He had a band called the Chicago Twisters in 66 that supposedly Tyrone Davis, you know, famed soul singer, started off with. But it's unclear on the single who it is. So, yeah, he was just seemed like he was off and running pretty quick. And you hear him play and you're like, oh, well, I can see why, because he is a shredder.
Yes, and this style of blues, you're right, his guitar playing is just, oh, it's tasty, it's so good, and it's more of the, you know, rock sort of Chicago-style blues where it's
very
thick,
electric,
you know?
Very electric, yeah. Like, I mean, of course, his first proper LP, which is actually a live album, recorded at this Bee's Lounge, and they actually had a label, too, I think, called Baby and Bee. But it only came out in France in 1977. It's like, what the heck? And it kind of shows you maybe where the blues were at in the 70s. They weren't really, I don't feel like it was really as appreciated here, you know, in its own backyard. And so here's this album recorded live in Chicago, released in France, and it smokes. It was a jaw dropper hearing his guitar tone is just so raw and biting and really accomplished too. You know, it's a rare combo to sort of hear and just jaw dropping to me. Like I don't even hear that many guitarists I'm impressed with anymore, that I feel like I've sought them all out. And I was like, whoa, you know, like this is insane. So yeah, that was actually his first actual, you know, LP. And then it took till, yeah, 80, the early 80s for him to sort of do a full original studio album, when I think the blues revival was sort of on a bit here and these guys were starting to get their due a little bit more.
So he is, in the meantime, going to be playing all over Chicago. I mean, he's playing with some of the greats. It's not like he's not doing anything related to music. He certainly is. And tell us what happens. So we're getting into the 80s here. He's got some recordings out there. Well, what's next here for Hip Link Chang?
I mean, he was kicking ass in the early 80s, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Like, it seemed like that was maybe his sort of golden hour, because he recorded this really cool, very different style, sort of country blues LP, like more acoustic, with Jimmy Rogers, who's like, you know, was actually even one of his idols. And then, yeah, he put out his first proper LP, and then he also recorded an LP with Jimmy Dawkins, who is like beyond legendary. I covered him in the strip so early on because he's just a giant, like one of probably the most celebrated, you know, blues sidemen guitarist, play with Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, the great of the greats. So yeah, he seemed to be doing really well. He's on this other guy, Eddie C. Campbell's album in the 80s as well. He's playing at Blues Chicago, which I read is maybe going to come back.
Really? Because that closed during COVID, right?
Yeah, I found a recent article in my this is why I love doing this, you know. I learned stuff too, and I was like, oh, it says it's maybe going to be reopening, actually. So yeah, that would be great. One of the only sort of like legit blues clubs, Northside Blues Club, yeah, whatever.
Great left, spot. You know? Great spot.
Yeah. He passed at the end of the 80s, 1989. He had cancer. So, you know, it's like he sort of, he had an impressive career, but he maybe went a little bit too soon, you know, to sort of get his full. I mean, they're still compiling his stuff. They're still putting it. There was a box set in like 2013 that he's on. You know, they're like he played with Pine Top Perkins. He played with all these, you know, legendary cats. So, you know, people are going to keep discovering him, like me, you know, forever probably. But, and if you're into the blues, definitely. And I also got to say, he was a snappy dresser too. Every picture I see of him, he's got a great hat on, from like a derby to a fedora, cool vest. He always looks good. He was a cool, I really wish I could have seen him do his thing. Like, but yeah, his legend will live on.
I'll tell you, I mean, something to be said about just going out and catching a blues show, maybe, you know, during the week or anytime, is a good time for blues, because you never know who you're going to see. I mean, Hip Link Chang was playing with these great local musicians, and I feel like you still can do that in Chicago. You could still go out any day of the week. Maybe the options are a little less now, but you could still see some incredible blues and do it for relatively cheap, and you can get, you know, basically front row.
I mean, he played with Barrel House Chuck at Blues. He passed away a couple of years ago. I saw a Tail Dragger there, who passed away, you know, like a couple of years ago or a year ago. So yeah, it's important to go. Rosa's is a great spot if you really want to see some legit old school cats. John Primer, who I covered about a year ago, I went and saw him, and I'm like, look at this guy, you know, he's amazing, you know, like he played with everybody, and there's other legends. Willie Buck hopped on stage with them, all these. So it really does kind of have the old spirit if you find the right night, and it's really important to appreciate these. Mary Lane came over to our table and started kind of singing to us. Was like, it was a pretty magical night last time I was there, and I'm just like, wow, yeah, you're right, this can still happen in the spirit of the days when, you know, these cats just all threw down together and you were part of the party. It's still happening.
I remember at Rosa's when I saw Sugar Blue a few years back. Mean harp player, one of the best, really. And he had a wireless microphone, and he ended up at our table playing the harp. And then all of a sudden he's behind the bar with the bartenders playing the harp as the band is still on stage. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And it's still possible to go see this stuff.
These guys are performers, you know, and that is sadly kind of a lost art, you know, rock guys try to do it and it's, you know, the histrionics seem forced and stuff these days, you know, unless you've been doing it for like 30, 40 years. But these cats, they put on a show, you know, and like they, and it works with the music and not totally lost though.
It's still possible to go see it.
It's possible to go see a really fun show.
and we should all celebrate the music of Hip Link Chain, a great guitar player. He was doing his thing for a long time here in Chicago, and he went too soon, and we are remembering him and his music today. We can get the full story if we go to chicagoreader.com and pick up a copy of The Reader. And look for The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. It is authored by Steve Krakow, who is a local musician, music historian, and artist. And he does a nice drawing by hand of Mr. Hip Link Chain. Steve, as always, sir, I appreciate it. And you stay hip. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 911 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help. And I hope you have a fantastic week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.